So this week's parasha is called Ki Tavo. So therefore, when they asked me 2 months ago for a title, so I called it Coming Home. And Ki Tavo Ol Haaretz. And somehow it worked out that that's what we're going to talk about. There are two mitzvot which are mentioned in this parasha that we're going to focus on. Afterwards, there's a large part of the parasha that deals with the tochacha, the rebuke prior to entering the land, but there are two mitzvot that are mentioned. These, when I call them mitzvot, it's actually, I want to be a little technical for a moment. What makes something into a mitzvah? Which is, how do you know that something is a mitzvah? Or for that matter, what does the word mitzvah mean? There are certain people that think that a mitzvah is a good deed, which is obviously not a very technical interpretation. What is the word itself, mitzvah? What does it mean?
What was commanded.
Excuse me?
What was commanded.
Correct. And we have all kinds of different ways of categorizing mitzvot. One of the most popular ways is what's called the 613 mitzvot. Now, even though that there's a general consensus that there are, in fact, 613 mitzvot, there is no consensus what those 613 mitzvot may be. Which means that a number of the Rishonim are basically working backwards. You know we got to get to 613, so let's start counting. Now, the two mitzvot that I'm going to talk about right now are not necessarily included in the 613, and that's because we have certain rules that make it into the 613. For example, something which is an ongoing mitzvah, something which is not limited, which means these two mitzvot are special things when you enter the land, and not only when you enter the land, you know, and I would now say generically, which means either when they came, you know, after the first temple was destroyed, or people came back subsequently after the second temple was destroyed, or anybody who gets on an Nefesh B'Nefesh flight would do these mitzvot. No, these mitzvot were only commanded one time in history, and that one time was when the Jews entered the land the first time. Consequently, they're not counted as a 613 mitzvot. Again, even though they are commandments, but they're not considered to be these ongoing commandments, as it were. And that's generally what is included. By the way, there are those who claim the word mitzvah does not mean commandment. There is among the Rishonim an opinion that says that the word mitzvah comes from the word bitzavta. Bitzavta means togetherness. Bitzavta, so mitzvah therefore would be the act of being together with God. Now, you know, I think that when it comes down to it, there's not that much of a difference. Why are you together? God told you to do it. Which means if you made up your own mitzvah, you know, you decided you want to do whatever ritual you want, then, and you say, but I'm hanging with God now, it's very difficult to say that, because what makes it a mitzvah is, of course, is the fact that God commanded it. But still, as I said, there are those who prefer to see the root rather than commandment, which perhaps is more forced. Rather, the result is one of being together with God, which may be a little, have somewhat of a different flavor to it. So let's look at the first of the two mitzvot that I'm referring to. It's in source number one. And again, if you need English, please bring an English chumash with you so we don't have to take up unnecessary pages with the translation. Other things I will try to translate as we go on. Today's class is actually going to be incredibly unconventional. So as far as things that I've done, maybe finally I found out what other people do, but let's continue. And Jane, stop looking ahead. Also, I'm not going to let you come back again. What? Vayitzav Moshe, this is Perek Kav Zayin, Posek Aleph. Vayitzav Moshe, v'ziknei Yisrael, et ha'am lemor. Shomor et kol ha'mitzvah asher nochi mitzavetchem hayom. You know, keep this entire mitzvah. So here you have that mitzvah. Keep the mitzvah. So again, I don't want to, you know, belabor this point, but again, it's funny. This is called the mitzvah very clearly, but though you will not find this listed in the 613. Keep this mitzvah hayom, right, today, which means it's only today. V'hayom, v'haya b'yom asher ta'avru et ha'yardein, and as that day, that as you cross over the Jordan River, el ha'aretz asher Hashem elokecha noten lach, to the land that God will give you, v'akimoti lecha avanim gdolot v'sarata otam b'sid. You will put up large stones, and you will cover them up with some kind of a limestone that will make it into some type of a blackboard. That's what will be accomplished with the line. V'katavta aleihem, and you should write upon them, et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot. You should write upon them all the words of this Torah, ba'avricha, leman asher tavo el ha'aretz Hashem lakecha noten lach, eretz zavat chalav udvash, kasher diber Hashem lakecha avotecha lach. Which are lots of words basically do this, because you're getting the land that God has promised, the land that flows with milk and honey, and so on. Now, what exactly are you supposed to do over here? It's not all that clear, and the Chumash then continues in Pasuk Dalet and says, "Vayaba arvechem et yarden, tokimu avonim ha'ele." You know, set up these stones, asher nochi mitzavetchem hayom, bahar eval. So now gave us a location. V'sadeta otam bisid, and again repeats the limestone. Uvanita sham mizbeach l'shem alokech mizbeach avanim, mizbach avanim lo tanif aleim barzel. Altar should be made out of stone, not to use any metal. Avanim shleimot tivnet mizbeach l'shem v'halita alav olot l'shem alokecha, and there you should bring these offerings to God. V'zavach l'shlamim, the difference between olot versus a shlamim. Olot is for God, shlamim is for us. Olot is completely consumed with fire. The shlamim are able to be eaten. Therefore, it says, "Valita olav olot l'Hashem lokecha." You bring these complete burnt offerings for God, and v'zavach to shlamim v'achal to sham v'samach. Right there, but the shlamim doesn't say for God. The shlamim is a way of that man will participate in it. V'samach l'fnei Hashem lokecha, and you should rejoice in front of God. Okay, so very nice. We have a ritual. We have the building of a mizbeach. We have the writing on a I don't know what color would lime be. White. So you have the coloring on a whiteboard. You have the korbanot mizbeach, and v'katavta al avanim. This is pasachet where it's bolded, and you should write on these stones et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot be'er hetev. And here it added in two words that was not in the previous couple of verses. And you should write the entire Torah, Be'er Hetev. What does Be'er Hetev mean? Before you tell me what it means, just what does it mean? Be'er Hetev. Clearly. The Chumash then continues and goes into another discussion. Be'itzav Moshe, Ve'idver Moshe Vakonim Levim Akol Yisrael Emor. Today you will become a people. You're going to keep all of the commandments and all the statutes. Which is very interesting because, you know, just to think, at which point do we become a people? So, you know, some people would argue the day that Avraham had a bad dream. Or you can say the day that perhaps the Jews left Egypt. Or perhaps the day that the Jews stood in front of Sinai. So over here we have another candidate for that description. At which point do they become a people? There's some aspect of peoplehood which happens now. Now, of course, the Zionists among us can say, go on, just that the fact that the people will now unite with their land, that then creates another aspect of peoplehood, which means an aspect of peoplehood where people are separated from their land means that something is, by definition, missing. Okay, and if anybody hears the recording and they're in Chutz La'aretz, don't worry, we're just kidding. You can be good Jews wherever you want to be. There's no reason to come over here, and you could be wonderful people over there, and so on and so forth. We don't want anyone to feel any guilt, you know, more than necessary, even though, of course, the Torah does say, today you become a people, and the reason why you become a people is because today you enter into the land. Okay, so hopefully that's clear, even though we know that we're missing all kinds of nuances. Correct. Continue. V'shamata b'kol Hashem Elokecha v'asita mitzvotav v'chukotav asher anochi mitzavcha hayom. Right. Pasuk Yud Aleph. V'yitzav Moshe et ha'am yom ahu lemor. Eli yamdu levarecha et ha'am al har gwizim ba'avrechem et ha'yarden. Shimon Levi Yehuda v'Yisachar Yosef v'Vinyamin ve'eli yamdu ala klala b'har eval Reuven Gad v'Asher u'zon dam v'Naftali v'anu levim v'omru al kol ish Yisrael kol ram. Now, this is the second mitzvah which was now given. What was the first mitzvah? Writing on the stones, right? What now is the second mitzvah which is being described? You're going to take the people, divide them into two halves or two groups, six tribes on one, six tribes on the other, and something's going to happen over there. There are going to be blessings, there are going to be curses. It said, Eile yamdu levareche ta'am, ve'eile yamdu ala klala, bahar eval. Some will stand to bless, some will stand there to curse. By the way, the blessings are never mentioned in the Chumash, only the curses. And then it goes and lists 11 or 12 different curses, which we'll get to in a little bit. First, another side point. The division of the tribes, which are one half is Shimon, Levi Yehuda, Yisachar Yosef Binyamin, and the other is Reuven, Gad, Asher, Zvon, Dan, v'Naphtali. There is no logical division over here. You can try anything that you want, B'nai Rachel, B'nai Leah, B'nai this, B'nai, but there will always be exceptions no matter what you try to divide them. I read an article on this a number of years ago in I believe it was in Tradition, which offered a mathematical solution to the problem, which was if you take all 12 tribes and you check the previous census and then try to divide them into as even a division as possible, these six and these six is the most even division of all mathematical calculations. If you take 12 and divide it to six and six, how many different possible ways of doing it? There's a mathematical formula to that. Where are my mathematical geniuses over here? No, now we back down. So that would be your homework. You can ask. You have to ask a mathematician this because it's a factorial. How many different ways are they divide 12 into 6 and 6? It's much more than you would think they are. What's the answer? It's a very large number. Correct.
Is that precise?
Yes, it actually is. I mean, that was a very good answer. No, because if you don't know math, and you just think, okay, 12 divided into 6 and 6, so that would just be, you know, how many... No, but it's a huge, huge number. But if you look, I saw a computer printout of it, of every single way of dividing it with what the population would be if it were divided in any other way other than this way, then it would have been uneven. This is the most even... As I said, this is your homework. Listen, it's important at the end of the day to have something to say by the Shabbos table. So this way you can stump all people there. You know, first of all, why is this division, and how many ways are there actually to divide 12 into 6 and 6? And again, the answer is this is the most even way of doing it. God did not need his computer for this. This was the way that the tribes were said to be divided. So this is the second mitzvah, to stand on the two mountains. And the question, of course, is for what purpose? Let's look at the curses that we find. Starting with Pasuk Tedvav. Arur ha'ish asher yaseh pesul ma'asecha. Toivat Hashem ma'aseh yedei charash. V'sam b'seter v'anu kol ha'am v'amru amen. Cursed is the person who makes idols. Cursed is the person, again, who is worshipping idols. Which means the worship of idolatry. And this, by the way, should be of no surprise. To a very great extent, maybe even more so than we modern people think today, to a very great extent, the Torah is, and especially the Navi, is a polemic against idolatry. The world that the Jews were entering is the world of idolatry. We are monotheists entering into a neighborhood of idolatry, and the monotheists cannot give in to the idolatry that we need to be successful and to keep our monotheism and actually to spread the monotheism, which is itself a very interesting challenge, being that we're generally not a religion that tries to go and find new followers. But on the other hand, it's not that we need to make more Jews, but we are on a search and destroy mission in terms of idols. So to find idolatry as the first objective should be of no surprise. The second one may be more of a surprise. Arur makle aviv imo v'mar kol ha'am amen. Cursed is the person who curses their father or mother. So I'm not sure if you would have, you know, if you would have said, okay, we're about to become a nation now, about to walk and be a nation, that this would have necessarily been what you would have chosen as number two. Number three, Arur Masigvul Re'ehu. Cursed is the person who, what is Hasagat Gvul in its most literal sense? What is Hasagat Gvul? So it's used today in terms of copyright, in terms of other things. Literally, it's moving the boundary between you and your neighbor. You have a yard that separates you and your neighbor. Your neighbor goes to sleep at night. You move the fence. When you move the fence, you then incorporate, right? You become a Zionist expansionist. And you take part of his property. So over here, we find the person who does this. This is not the first time it's mentioned in the Chumash. So that's the next thing which is mentioned. Arur Mashge Iver Badarech. Curse the person who... Now, this is interesting, because this you're also... Excuse me? Correct. And this we're more familiar with from its original time that was stated in the Torah, which is Lifnei Iver Lo Titein Michshol, not to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. So this is somebody who messes up a blind person. So that's a very good... So that's a very good question. By the way, you asked, you already have a suspicion that it's not necessarily literally... You know, picking on blind people, but it's also in terms of giving bad advice and so on and so forth. Correct. Next, Arur Matem Mishpat Ger Yatom Valmana. Curses the person who causes an incarriage of justice among the stranger, among the orphans, and among the widows, which basically the weak or the disenfranchised within society. Then we get into the sexual laws. So there couldn't be like a real quick, oh, listen, by the way, try to behave. Arur shochevim eshet aviv, curses the person who sleeps with his father's wife. Arur shochevim kol behema, curses the person who sleeps with any animal. Arur shochevim achoto, curses the person who sleeps with their sister. Arur shochevim chotanato, curses the person who sleeps with their mother-in-law. So over here we have four, you know, different laws mentioned in terms of sexuality, which of course, you know, jumps out at you. The next one, Arur Maker Re'ehu, cursed is the person who hits their neighbor Basater, secretly. Arur Lokeach Shochad, Lahakot Nefesh Dam Naki, cursed is the person who takes a bribe in order to cause an innocent blood to be spilled. And then finally, I said there were either 11 or 12. The 12th is Arur Shel Yokim, it's Devrei HaTorah Hazot. Cursed is the person who doesn't keep this Torah. So the question is, if this is all-inclusive, everything in the Torah, or this is just these 11, which is all-inclusive? So is this really a reiteration of the 11, or is this something which is independent? And we look at this list, and we are really somewhat mystified as far as, you know, what this list is. Now, I saw somebody who made a suggestion that all of these things are things which are done secretly. So all the sexual things, it's easy to say, are secret. Moving the boundaries, generally, you're not going to do it in broad daylight. To give the person either bad advice or, you know, to hurt the blind, especially if it's bad advice, then it gets secret. The person who curses their parents, I don't see how you can easily fit that in. But you'll notice that by the idolatry, it does use the word, yidei charash, which means visam bisater, which means, and there it is, secret. Hitting somebody, it also says basater, the word secretly is there, and taking a bribe is generally something that you do. So the argument, except, you know, with the exception of cursing the parents, is not a terrible argument, but I do want to remind you of another verse, and that's in source number 2. And those of you who have no idea where I'm going yet, don't worry, you'll figure it out very soon. Source number 2, Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu v'negot lanu levanenu ad olam lasot kol divrei Torah hazot. The secret things are for God, and the revealed things are for us and our children forever. Rashi comments on this, Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu. Secret things are God's worry, or God's concern. V'in tomru, and if you're going to say, Mayu b'yadeinu la'asot, atama anish et harabim alhi hurei hayachid. That God, you punished the masses for the sin or the thoughts of the individual. Shenemar pen yesh b'chem ish v'charkach re'uat makot ha'aretzahi v'lo ein adam yodea tmunotav shel chavero. A person doesn't know what evil lurks in the minds of others. Ein ani ma'anish etchem. Correct. Em ani. You just show your age when you respond to those things. I've never heard it, but I've heard my father enough times. Okay. Those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, it's good. Okay. This is before there was television, okay?
Ain
ani ma'anish et... I know. I have to keep them awake. Ain ani ma'anish etchem ala nisterot. God says, I am not going to punish you for the secret things. Shehin la'shem lokenu. That's what it says, anisterot la'shem lokenu. V'hu yifra me'oto yachid. That when it comes to the secret things that you do, God will punish a person individually. Aval ha'niglot, when it comes to the revealed things, lanu v'neinu liva'er harami kirbeinu. That means we have a responsibility when people do things which are wrong publicly or where it's known. V'im lo na'aseh din bahem yanshua terabim. And if society does not respond to the behavior which is known, then God says, I will punish society. Nikud alanu ulavaneinu. The way it's written in the Torah on top, there are dots written on top. L'drosh sha'af al ha'niglot lo anash et harabim ad she'avrua tayardain. That even regarding the revealed things, that people were not mutually responsible until they passed the Jordan. Mishekiblu aleihem et hashfu'a, when they accepted the vow, b'har grizimu b'har eval, v'nasu arevim zelazeh. When they accepted the vow in Har Gerizim and Har Eval, and then they became mutually responsible, which, by the way, is the exact opposite of what I had just suggested before. What did Rashi say over here? Let's go back to what I said earlier. There's something about becoming a people. What made us into a people at this point? Do you see what Rashi's claiming? Rashi's saying that at a certain juncture, there is another level of peoplehood which is achieved. And again, this has to do with entering the land of Israel. And I'll explain exactly why that will be. Yeah?
So basically he's saying that we are all responsible even for the revealed things.
Only for the revealed.
Only for the revealed things. So how do you explain, say, for Yeshua with the... Ahab, right? Who stole the things...
Achan.
And everyone was punished. If nobody knew about it, and that wasn't one of the revealed things.
Well, the question is, how many people knew or didn't know about it? Because there was a group over there, but it is definitely a fair question to ask. But let's focus for a second on what Rashi is saying here. Rashi is telling us that there is a level of peoplehood which is achieved, and what is the level of peoplehood achieved? And at which point? He says clearly, when you cross the Jordan, but not just crossing the Jordan, when you cross the Jordan, and when you stand by Har Eval, which means the very scene that we're talking about, Rashi says something took place over here, and what is that? It's mutual responsibility for revealed things, not for the secret things, which is very interesting, because again, if you want to claim that the things that they actually took an oath on over there were things that were secret, Rashi understands that that's not what they were responsible for. They're only responsible for what is revealed. And again, why would this be? When we enter the land of Israel, let's just think about the economy for a second. An economy, not in modern times, in ancient times, even though it's somewhat true today as well. In ancient times, what was the economy based on? It was based on agriculture. What's agriculture based on? It's based upon amount of rain, which means it's not going to be a situation that I'm going to get rain in my field and you're not going to get rain in your field. Either it's going to rain or it's not going to rain. And this is a theme which is very, very clear in the Chumash. And for that matter, other places in Tanakh, in terms of having a drought or having rain, having plenty or being cursed. And what it's saying over here is that when it comes to being in the land of Israel and having a collective economy, so we have mutual responsibility, and then there will be either mutual punishment or not. So let's now go back to the beginning and understand what it is that we want to try to get to today. We have two commandments, and what we really want to understand is, what are these commandments? These are commandments which are one-time commandments. These commandments are not every time you come, not every person who gets off of an LL flight has to make these 12 oaths, although maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea. But this was a one-time thing which was done as a nation, which was done standing on two mountains, where they need to accept these things, and then they become a people. Rashi's claim is, what is the essence of peoplehood over there? Mutual responsibility, but mutual responsibility for the revealed things, secret things is on God's problem, is God's concern, and this is our concern. So the first issue is, what is the correlation or the relationship between these two commandments? And the reason why I'm even posing the question, it's not as if these two commandments are written in two separate places. They're written together. They're actually written together almost as one, almost within one breath. And is there any kind of relationship between them, or these two separate actions? Or is the relationship? Second question. The content of the second thing, namely these 11 or 12 curses or vows, why are those particular ones chosen? And it's also, this also was only done once, only performed one time. No, the vow, the acceptance is only one time. So the question is, why were these chosen? And for that matter, you then can ask yourself another question, why were others, which you, some other really good candidates, were left out? Okay. Okay. Excuse me? Ah. And then the clearest question would be, what is the correlation between these and the Aseret HaDibrot, which I'll get to in a second. The Chizkuni in source number 4 says, Avanim Gdolot, Lahachil Ktav Cheshbon Mitzvot HaTorah Kamo Shektvot Bilchot Gdolot B'inyan HaAzharot. Exactly what he is saying, I'm not going to tell you, but I'll tell you what he's not saying. He's not saying you're going to write the whole Torah. He's talking about some kind of headlines, and not necessarily to write all of the... He's not talking about writing everything down. It's really what he would consider more headlines. Rashi writes, Be'er Hetev, and Rashi over here is in fact following something which is taught in the Gemara. It's B'shiv'im Lashon. What did we say the words Be'er Hetev meant? To explain it clearly. So Rashi understands that to explain it clearly means in every language imaginable. Just to contrast that, look at the Ibn Ezra in source number 6, Be'er Hetev. What does he write? Ibn Ezra was clearly a school teacher. And he writes, Haktiva has to be Be'er Hetev. Make it readable. Which, by the way, there is a huge difference between Rashi and the Ibn Ezra. I mean, Rashi is saying that whatever you're writing, multiply it by 70 times. Ibn Ezra is saying whatever you write, make sure that you use clear penmanship. Right, make it very, very clear and write it that it could be read. Okay, again, there is a huge difference between the two, and it's something which we need to think about. Source number 7, the Meshivat Nefesh writes, Pirish Rashi ba'ayin lashon, k'tzat tema, midoch kol afarishken. What in the world made Rashi explain it this way? Which means, his question is a fair question, not a fair question. Why did Rashi explain it this way? You know the answer already. What's the answer? Because the Gemara explained it that way. But what's he asking is, meaning Rashi generally tells us, he's trying to explain the Pshat and the Chumash. What made Rashi think that the Pshat and the Chumash is that you're going to write it not necessarily on two rocks, but you're going to fill up 70 rocks, as it were, or 104, whatever it is. I mean, it becomes very interesting. Now, as far as this question or tension between Rashi, between the Chizkuni, let's say, sorry, before I ask about the tension, let me read what the Ramban says. In source number 8, V'katavta leim et kol divrei Torah zot, Amar of Avraham, B'shem Haga'on, this is Ibn Ezra, Shekatvu leim minyan ha-mitzvot, K'mo k'tavot b'chol k'dolo k'in azharot. It only has the list of the mitzvot, which means list the mitzvot, which means presumably this would mean the 613 mitzvot, the list of the mitzvot, and not, let's see, v'tam be'eretev haktiva v'rabbeinu amr, the Gemara says, b'shivim lashon, that's what Rashi had said, u'matzinu b'sefer tagi shaita kol ha-torah k'tuva b'hen mibreshet ad le'inei kol Yisrael. That, there's a book that deals with the tagim. The tagim is the scribal ornaments written on the letters. There it claims that the Torah was written from the first letter to the last letter, all 304,805 letters of the Torah are written right there on these stones. So again, you have a huge difference over here. Again, what's the maximalistic position? The maximalist position will be, you have the entire Torah translated 70 times. And what's the minimalist position? The minimalist position is, you have the 613 commandments written clearly. Again, there is a very, very big difference between them. But now I want to go back to my previous question. But exactly, so what is the correlation between this and between then these 11 or 12 that were said? Now, the problem in the text that exists that would cause someone to think that you have to write the entire Torah is what? If you go back in Source 1 in Pasachet, V'katavta levanim et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot be'er hitev. So what do the words et kol divrei ha-Torah hazot mean? Yeah, which word is the key word over there? Look at source number. Look at source number 9 and 10. In source number 9, it's from the very beginning of Devarim, right when it tells us what Moshe is doing in Sefer Devarim. Be'er yadein be'er et Moav ho'il Moshe be'er et ha-Torah hazot. Oh, by the way, here it's not be'er hetev, it's be'er. So whether this is the same or not, we'll leave as an open question. But look at source 10. Umi goy gadol ha-shelo chukim u'shabatim tzadikim ki kol ha-Torah hazot. Asher anochi noten lefnechem hayom. So over here, Moshe is saying, "Kikol haTorah hazot." So the question is again, how literal to be? Moshe says, "I'm giving you the entire Torah today." Did Moshe really give the entire Torah in Perek Dalet Pasuk Chet? Which means, does that really mean everything? So, I agree. You said the Ten Commandments before. I agree that the first thing that came to my mind when I looked at these 11 was to try to compare them to the Aseret HaDibrot. Because, let's think a second. When we say, Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, or when we say we received the Torah on the holiday Shavuot, we received the Torah, what did we really receive by Har Sinai? We received the Ten Commandments. What did we receive on Shavuot? We received the Ten Commandments. Now, there are various interpretations, some of this we've seen in the past, that if you understand the Ten Commandments properly, you will realize that all 613 commandments are actually subsumed within them. Which means, are the Ten Commandments supposed to be 10 specific points? Or could the Ten Commandments be understood as 10 general categories? Okay, that itself would make a very big difference. And there are those who then went and tried and showed that you could take all 600 of the commandments and put them in 10, which means if someone would have had a commentary over here and would have said, when it says to put the entire Torah on these two stones, on the limestone, and someone would have said, and that means to write the 10 commandments, we would not have had a problem. Correct or no? I mean, on the Pasuk, in Perek Kaf Dalet and Shmot, Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Yud, Perek Kaf Dalet Pasuk Yud Bet, Vayomer Shemosha Leh Alei Ha'har VeYeshem. That Nelacha Luchura Evan Vahatorah Bahamitzvah Shakatafki Laratam. Rashi on this pasuk says that, hold it, is it just the Luchota Evan or is it the Torah and the Mitzvah? So what does Rashi say? That all 613 commandments are actually subsumed within the Ten Commandments. What did God give Moshe? When Moshe comes down from the mountain, what does Moshe come down with? Only two tablets. So what happened to the Torah and the Mitzvah? He says, no, the entire Torah really is in the Ten Commandments. But in a, Rashi claims that the entire thing is within the Ten Commandments. Is within the Ten Commandments, and if you understand the Ten Commandments properly, you will realize that the Ten Commandments are actually. Yes. And Rashi quotes it there. Yes. Right. Yeah. Rashi quotes it there. So if you take a look at that, Rashi realizes. So as I said, I would not therefore be troubled at all if someone were to have said, "Oh, you write the entire Torah on these two stones." So what do the two stones come out to? The same thing as the Shnei Luchot HaBrit. It comes out as being, which means we received the luchot once from God over here. God is saying, "Okay, we enter the land. Put you know, as our national symbol, right? Symbols are very interesting. I mean, what's the symbol today in of the state of Israel?
The menorah.
The menorah, which Professor Sperber has shown, is not an authentic menorah. We have a non-authentic menorah as the symbol of the state of Israel. Okay, you can do with that whatever what you can do with that whatever you choose to, but that the symbol should be the Aseret HaDibrot. That's not a very bad symbol. Not only as a symbol, but as a message. It's more than that. That to have the Aseret HaDibrot, of course, to have said it, it could have been said in a clearer way, which means we're really back to our problem again. But again, let's move over a second. The Aseret HaDibrot is part of the discussion because, again, just in an associative level, in a visual level, when you talk about writing commandment on two sets of stones, right? Again, it's almost like a no-brainer. So then when you continue and then you look at these 11 or 12 and you compare them to the Aseret HaDibrot, so what is your very quick conclusion? It doesn't work. So first,
and they have to be refined.
Okay. But first, let's take a look and see the comparison, and see if we can force our way. And that's source 13, which is not a source, just that I made it up.
you really have to stretch to put these.
I stretched a little bit, not terribly.
Is it possible
that? But first, let's look at source 13. Anochi, I didn't have such a difficulty sticking that within the peso and masecha. Which means I'm God. Don't make it. Although it's again, you can claim I'm stretching it. Lo yelecha. That's not so bad comparing it to making idols. Lo tisa. Right. That's not so bad comparing it to perverting justice. What is notably missing? Zachor yom haShabbat l'kadesho. That's what's missing. Which means again, let's be very, very clear. What's missing from this list that you can't, you can stretch, you can turn, you can do anything you want, but it's not there. What's not there? Shabbat is not there. Afterwards, honoring your parents. Don't curse your parents. That works. Don't murder. Don't beat your neighbor, right? Don't commit adultery. That's the easiest one, right? There you have 6, 7, 8, and 9 are all there. Don't steal. Don't move the boundaries, right? Lo tanabarecha et sheker. Don't take shochad. Lo tachmod. Don't mislead your friend. Which means the rest of them are not all that difficult. Anochi is a little bit harder, but Shabbat isn't there. Which means no matter which way you're going to twist or turn, or try to interpret, very very simply.
And good.
That's not there. Lo tanaf became multiplied. So then you'd have to say, now you can continue and say, well, this must be more of a concern to enter into the society, which, by the way, is also not a terrible thing to say. We're about to enter into an immoral society where people do all kinds of immoral things sexually, so it needs to be spelled out a little bit more. Okay, by the way, that's also very interesting social comment to say, to see the focus on the sexual sins.
Is it possible that these are divided up into the big three? Avodah Zarah, Shifuch Damim, sexuality?
The problem is the parents then.
The parents,
and the stealing. And the stealing doesn't really fit in, you know, that easily as well. So that didn't seem to have worked out all that well. I could defend the missing, that Shabbat is missing, by claiming as follows, which is weak. You can decide if it's weak. That there's been such an emphasis on Shabbat till this point that it should be clear. But I'll refine that a little bit. There are two major tochachot in the Torah, right? Two major sections of rebuke. One of them is in this week's parasha. The other one is in Sefer Vayikra. The major theme of the tochacha in Vayikra really is Shabbat. And just to illustrate that, source number 14, which isn't from Vayikra. At the very end, where it talks about the whole Torah, it says, "Az tirtze ha'aretz et shabtoteha, kol yimei ha'shama, v'atem be'eretz eivechem, az tishbot ha'aretz v'artzita et shabtoteha, kol yimei ha'shama, tishbot et asher lo shavta b'shabotuchem b'shiftechem aleha." Now, the truth is, that's not just Shabbat. It's Shabbat in a multiple sense, also in terms of Shabbat of the land, because, and that's one of the themes at the end of Vayikra, that there's more than one type of Shabbat. There's a type of Shabbat which is the seventh day, and there's a type of Shabbat which is the seventh year. And over here, there's at least an equal emphasis on the seventh year. So as I said, it really may be stretching it a little bit. So I want to try another way. I'm going to try another way now. And this is the verse that it quotes, and the teaching here is a little bizarre, but it's interesting. The verse is from Shir HaShirim in Source 15. Shnei Shadayich Kishnei Afarim Tu'umei Tzviya Haroim Bashoshanim. I'm not sure if anybody ever tried this on you as a pickup line, but it translates as Shnei Shadayich, like two breasts, Kishnei Afarim, are like two fawns, Tu'umei Tzviya, that are twins of gazelle, Haroim Bashoshanim, which feed among the lilies. And you can just look at this and you say, I don't know what you're talking about, right? Right? Okay. So now look what Rashi does with this. Shnei shadayich haminikot otcha zemoshe v'aron. First are there the two breasts that give you sustenance, or Moshe and Aaron. Shnei afarim tu mei tzviya, derech tzviya liyot yulad etomim. The way of the gazelle is to be born as twins. I don't know. Kach shneim shavim shkulim ze kaze. Therefore, there's an equality between the two. Davar acher, another interpretation. Shnei shadayach al shem haluchot. Tomei tzviya shehem mechuvanot b'mida achat. The two of them are really twins in a sense. V'chamisha dibrot al zu. V'chamisha alzu mechuvanim dibur keneged dibur. What Rashi just now said is that in reality, even though we have 10 commandments, we really have 5 run-on sentences. Now, just in case you're not clear what he's saying, let's read the words and then we'll look at it visually right underneath. Anochi keneged lo tirtzach. Now, look underneath for a second. If you were to read them across, right? So then, have any of you ever heard this before? Okay? So here is where Rashi and others say it afterwards. I'm not sure. I mean, wouldn't it make sense that Rashi is the first one, but I didn't work hard enough to see what his source was, but here it's very clear. Rashi is saying is that Anochi is connected to Lo Tirtzach. How? Sheharotzeach ma'et et hadmut shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Man is created in the image of God, so anybody who kills somebody diminishes the image of God, which, by the way, it says that very clearly in Bereshit. It says that anybody who kills has diminished the image of God, which means why can't you kill? So on the one you could say you can't kill because you're not allowed to kill. No, you can't kill because you're not allowed to diminish the image of God, which is really then, again, reading that run-on sentence, Anochi run from right into Lo Tirtzach left. Next. Lo Yelecha keneged Lo Tinaf. You should have no other gods and not to commit adultery. Shehazonach or Avodah Zarah, Derech eshet ha-mena'efet, tachet isha, tikach et zarim. That in a sense, committing adultery is the same thing as idolatry. That we have a relationship with God, and committing adultery is really, when it comes down to it, it's the same thing. Lo tisa keneged lo tignov. Not to take God's name in vain, and not to steal. Shagonev sofali shaveh l'sheker. The person who steals will end up making a vow and using God's name in vain. Zachor keneged lo ta'aneh. Right? To keeping Shabbat versus testimony, shamachalel at Shabbat meid sheker b'boro lomer shalosh Shabbat b'Shabbat bereshit. That there is, it's in a sense false testimony, miscarriage of justice, and saying that God did not really create. Kaved keneged lo tachmod shachomer chomed sofa lo lid ben shemakle oto umachabed lemisha eno aviv. If I take this interpretation, then I can really stretch a little bit more and try to throw Shabbat. And I'll try to throw Shabbat into Lokeach Shochad, maybe, or miscarriage of justice, and so on. Right. But again, it's not an easy task. Which therefore leaves me again with the understanding that Shabbat is missing from this list. Okay? You can work as hard as you want, if I convinced you so far that it's really there, then I work too hard. Because, and then you have to work so hard for something, you realize that it's there's something inauthentic. Shabbat is not there. Very, very simply. We have, if you even want to say basic morality, you have basic morality, but okay, honoring parents or not cursing parents is there. Shabbat is not there.
Yeah. What are the other roads where you get thrown out of the land?
They're not all here either.
Rashi has this theory.
Yeah.
It's the only place in Tanakh we can find to give that theory. Like in that pasuk. Like,
you don't like the verse that he chose?
So let's
work a little bit harder then. The second choice, after we don't find it in the Ten Commandments, where would be the next place that we would look? The Shev Mitzvah B'nei Noach. Which, just in case you don't remember them all, take a look at source 17. Right away you know Shabbat's not there, so that's going to make it easier. But over here you have a problem also. Prohibition of idolatry, that works, that was number one. Prohibition of murder was number two. Prohibition of theft, 3 and 4. Prohibition of sexual morality, you can throw in 6, 7, 8, and 9. Prohibition of blasphemy, you can put in with number two. The prohibition of eating flesh taken from an animal while it's still alive. Eivir min hachai. Eivir min hachai is missing, which means the same way that Shabbat is missing from one, Eivir min hachai is missing over here. And again, I could work harder. I could work a little bit harder and make the following claim. According to Torah law, this is one of these questions designed only to bother you. Okay, for no other reason. According to Torah law, did you hear me very clearly just now? What did I just say? Good. According to Torah law, if you get, God forbid, someone's in a plane accident, a plane crash, right? And the person next to them was eating a ham and cheese sandwich, right? And the plane crashes, and they have no food. And they have the choice either of eating the ham and cheese sandwich or eating the person sitting next to them. In terms of halacha, in terms of Torah law, which one is better? Okay. How do you know that you can't eat ham and cheese? No, Galiv Chaleva doesn't apply, by the way. Doesn't apply. Because you can't eat pig. It happens to say in the Torah you can't eat pig. Where does it say in the Torah that you can't eat Frank? Right. Where does it say, he's dead. Where does it say that you can't eat him? I said Torah law. Where does it say you can't eat him? What's the answer? So the answer is, he's dead. What's the answer? The answer is, it never says that you can't eat a human being. Have any of you been to college? Yes. Have any of you been to college? Do you know that there are certain advanced classes that in order to take it, there are prerequisites? You can't take that class until you took the prerequisite. It's possible that the Torah has a prerequisite. You know what the prerequisite is? You have to know by yourself that you shouldn't be eating other human beings, and now we can start talking about the other commandments. But wait a second. Does everything have to be legislated? If something's not legislated, it then becomes ethical and moral? I'm just pointing out that as far as pure Torah law goes, you can't eat pig. As far as pure Torah law goes, it doesn't say you can't eat another human being. You know why? Because it may not be necessary to tell you that you can't eat another human being. Because that's certain things you need to get by, you understand by yourself. One second. Is this point understood? Or no? What? Okay. So I will tell you now, the Torah tells you can't eat milk and meat, the Torah tells you that you can't eat pig, the Torah never said you can't eat another human being. So as I said, I think that certain people who should have ethical sensitivity, I would use the same argument over here, perhaps, as why Eivir min hachai is missing. Is that Eivir min hachai needed to be said as one of the Shev Mitzvah B'Noach at the dawn of history. But it's not necessarily as important on a day-to-day basis. By the way, don't rip a limb off of an animal and, you know, and eat it. As much as don't sleep with that person, don't sleep with that person, and don't even sleep with that person may have been more necessary to save you. Again, I'm just suggesting, although I do still have to point out that when... I do have to point out that Shabbat is missing in terms of my comparison with the Aseret HaDibrot. And on the other hand, I'm missing Eivir Min HaChai over here.
But Eivir Min HaChai, we were talking about people that knew about Korbanot. And the halachot of Korbanot were very known because it was strategy. So you would not go and take a piece of animal to eat it.
Right.
Because you knew you had to give your animal such a high level of
right.
perfection. So that's already an educational system.
So which bothers you more, that Shabbat is missing? Meaning, which comparison...
Both of them don't bother me.
Oh, good, nothing
because
bothers you.
Because when I look at the list,
yeah.
it more bothers me that they had to be put more morality details
right.
as opposed to anything else, because that was to be the biggest concern.
Right. But which, again, basically what I'm really asking is, which comparison, which are both failed comparisons... Which comparison do you like better? That's really the whole thing that I wanted to get to today. Is the comparison with Aseret HaDibrot, despite Shabbat being missing, a better comparison, or with the Sheva Mitzvot, a better comparison, despite the fact that Eivir Min HaChai is missing? Which one is ultimately a closer, is more, can I, is this English? Is a better correlation to what these 11 are? Look, there's clearly a correlation, let's state the obvious. There's clearly a correlation between these 12 curses and the Aseret HaDibrot. There's clearly a correlation between these 12 and the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. My question is, which is a better correlation? And by the way, what I said earlier in terms of the Aseret HaDibrot not being 10 specific laws, but 10 generalities, that's even more the case when it comes to the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. These are seven categories, which means it's seven categories in terms of one of them has to theft. It's all types of theft. Right, it's not whether you have a gun or don't have a gun. Whatever, it's all kinds of theft and all kinds of sexuality and all kinds of other issues. Which means, which correlation is a better correlation? So, I think that we have most of the pieces now to try to put this all together. But still, let's put it all together. Let's look at what Rav Hirsch has to say regarding the words Be'er Hetev. אפשר היה לפרש את הביטוי הזה על פי האמור בחבקוק, כתב חזון ובער על הלוחות למען ירוץ קורא בו. לפי זה, בער היטב מורה שהכתב חייב להיות ברור וקרי. Which means he's really leaning in the same direction as we saw in the Ibn Ezra. That when it says בער היטב, it really means write clearly. He notices, however, אולם במסכת סוטה, Pirshu et Be'er, al pi amor la'el, ha'oil Moshe Be'er et ha'Torah hazot, the verse we saw also, Be'er etev mora efo, sheyesh lefaresh devrim ula, karev otam ela havana. That means that you need to make them clearer and more easily understood. V'lamdu mikan, she'tek zesh shel ha'Torah, kalal gam tergum, l'tzorach havanat umot ha'olam. She'ken Yisrael hu... Okay, one second, let's pause a second before we continue. Were we thinking about the implications of translating into 70 languages? 70 languages is, the number 70 is the number that Chazal used for the nations of the world, right? I don't know how many members of the UN they had at that point. 70 nations is the totality of the nations of the world. When it says over here 70 languages, what does that mean to us? It means translated into every language. That's what 70 means. Where did the number 70 come? If you count at the end of Parsha Noach, there were 70 descendants over there who are enumerated. Those 70 descendants, the ones who populated the world, therefore those are the 70 nations. All nations that come from those 70 different families, as it were.
It's interesting when they translate the Torah to 70 languages, they talk about Septuagint.
Yes. Right. Targum HaShivim, correct. But that's because of a separate... So what's the implication of translating into 70 languages? What?
This is a proclamation to the world.
Which means, who is your audience? That's always an important question. It's always an important question.
It's not for the Jewish people. They didn't need 70. They were the ones who were supposed to write it for themselves. Why over, and they're all seeing it as they cross over. All the other nations are not coming by that rock.
You know what? Somebody asked me to write a book review recently. But they didn't. But I said, "Where will it be?" They didn't know yet where it would be. I found it incredibly difficult to write without knowing who my audience was. What do I focus on more? On this part or that part? I find it incredibly difficult to write something not knowing who my intended audience was, because it's going to go in one place. So then you have an idea. Over here as well, knowing your audience makes a difference in terms of how you go about explaining something. Which means, is this? Let's just think a second. If we take the maximalistic position, the entire Torah from beginning to end written in all 70 languages, that's a very interesting idea. And it really does go towards this concept that, let me back up a step. What's the purpose of it? Why are we translating Torah into all these languages? What? So is it that we want to convert them all? I mean,
that's, God repeats this over and over and over. He's going to take us out of Egypt, and he's going to bring us into Israel so that we can be legoim, that we can be send the message on to the non-Jews. It's not just supposed to be for us.
Right, but what's the message that we're sending on? Again, for example, do we send on to them the message? And
yeah,
you said,
no, we don't do Shabbat. Shabbat's just for us.
Very good.
Very good. Murder,
good, good. You know. So the fact that Shabbat is missing over here, and by the way, just realize I just confused two different things. What were the two things that I confused? What's written on these tablets versus the 11 or 12. Right. So now I'm asking, is that really a mistake of what I'm saying? Which is, we don't know what's written. Kol HaKetorah Zot. So which is the Zot? Who is the Zot? Who are we talking about? Are we talking about, again, the entire Torah, list of mitzvot? Are we talking about perhaps even the 11 or 12 things that are about to be said? Which is, so raising that question, again, the correlation between these two, and I think you all understand why I would suggest that there is a correlation between the two, because these are two laws which are really being stated together. Let's continue now in Rev Hirsch, because he's saying, okay, say it's in all 70 languages, Shekein Yisrael hu rachok me oto particularism hamyuchas lo ayidei zarim, that Judaism is not going to be exclusive. Elamei rosh ra'a et shlichuto b'havaat geula ruchanit u'musarit l'kol ha'enoshut, that Judaism sees its role of bringing about spiritual and moral revolution to all of humanity. Im knisata Torah la'eretz Yisrael, and as the Torah enters into the land of Israel, kvar hachila yeshuat ha'atid shel kol ha'amim, which means entering into the land of Israel is the beginning of the end of the redemption, in the sense of our influencing other nations. And again, realize that part of influencing other nations, if Jews aren't supposed to be a light unto the nations, there's a light unto nations as an individual Jew who lives up the block in an Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn, and then there's Jews as a nation who live as a nation. Which means it's a different challenge of being an Or LaGoyim as an individual versus being an Or LaGoyim as a national entity. And as a national entity, the stakes are far higher. Which is, now we're about to enter the land, we do have a responsibility as this Or LaGoyim. He says, "V'lo od el amusham shetirgum ze kalal gam et hanimuk legirush ha'amim haknaniim." That included over here, he says, that we're also explaining why the Canaanites are being kicked out. Right, and you shouldn't follow the practices of the Canaanites. By the way, what else do you find in that part? When it says don't follow the practices of the Canaanites, that's Perek Kaf Pasuk Yud Chet. Yeah. There, that particular pasuk he quotes does not go into it as much as in other places, where it speaks of the practices of Egypt and the practices of the Canaanites that you should follow, where there really is a focus there on sexual sins. So it's interesting that over here he is playing with this idea that what's being written on these stones really will be outer directed and not inner directed. Let's look at the Abarbanel in source 20. Again, he's going on the same psuk in the same area.
What supports that, by the way, is there's not also Brit Milah is not on there, none of the Chagim are on there.
None of the things
that are particular to Am Yisrael.
So now say it again. Which is a better comparison, the Sarah to Dibrot or the Shev Mitzvah Pidin Noach? It's more closely correlated to the Shev Mitzvah B'nei Noach, and again I'll say it very clearly: the fact that Shabbat is missing from the list, and that's the most obvious thing. The fact that Shabbat is missing really does push you in this direction that maybe this is, you know, going outward. Let's take a look at the Abarbanel. Avatatir, what's underlined? Avatatir e shekamol shebi'er be'inyan hamitzvot shehivi b'sefer hazeh kam inyanim. Basically saying, look at the parsha here as a continuation to what was said in B'chukotai, which, by the way, if you do that, then suddenly Shabbat does appear. Afterwards, where it's underlined, he goes on to say something very interesting. The day that you enter into the land should be a new type of Matan Torah. By the way, the second he says this, in which direction now does he push this? More towards the Aseret HaDibrot. L'chein ra'a l'tzavot aleim she'asu b'hachnasam dugmat mashahu alav ha'shalom Yisrael asu b'machrat yom ha'ma'amad b'zeh shekimu et avanim. If you'll notice, when the Jews stood by Har Sinai, they also built a Mizbeach, and they also brought Olam, they also brought Shlamim, which means the building of the Mizbeach over here is reminiscent of Matan Torah, and therefore what he's saying is that the Jews standing and accepting the Torah is a new generation accepting the Torah as we enter into the land, and therefore it's much closer to Sarat Dibrot. He continues and he says, V'shekatvu et ha-Torah ala avanim, shehu kalu kima'ase avotehem kasher amdu al har sinai vikiblu et ha-Torah mitzuraf shebiz, again, very clearly like Matan Torah, mitzuraf shekiyim bize gam mitzvat vikataftem al mezuzot beitech uvisharecha. Now, this is a fascinating statement that he makes. He says, you know what this, again, it's pure associative thinking. What does it say about the mezuzah? Where do you put it? You put it on on the doorposts of what? The doorposts of your homes and of your gates. Ulechein tziva ka'asher ya'avru et ha-Yarden, when the Jews cross over the Jordan River, yichtivu et ha-Torah al avanim, sheze kidmut mezuzah b'sha'ar shenichnasim bo. That if this is where they enter into the land of Israel, that becomes the gate, as it were, of entering into the homeland. This is the gate that they walk through. What do you do when you build a new home? You have to put up the gate. What do you put up the gate? You put up the mezuzah. So he says, this is putting the mezuzah. V'neit ba'er mizeh, kalusha mitzvot avanim, hi michlal habrit kimo ha'orim shetiva lehem har hagrizim har eval, ki al kein hayta hakamat avanim ha'ele al har eval, v'orim v'aklalot nimrim sham aliyot kol zeh mi'etzem habrit. So he's claiming that whatever is taking place there is a new old covenant. Which is the covenant? It's the covenant that took place by Har Sinai, which basically means we have not resolved our problem, and we'll end today without resolving our problem. But in a sense, what I've really given you is two approaches. One approach is that these curses are similar to the Aseret HaDibrot. The other approach is that it's similar to the Shev Mitzvah B'nei Noach. Right? I'm not deciding between these two approaches. I'm leaving it up to you. You can decide which one you like better. I'm leaving what's written on the stone because nobody knows it's written on the stone, especially because it was a one-time mitzvah. It wasn't necessary. When you find it, you let me know what it says. Let me just conclude. If this is terribly frustrating that we don't know what's written, and we don't, but at least we can do the following. What we're trying to do today is to look at something which really isn't clear. We try to understand it. We presented two different models. One model is based upon the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach. One model is based upon the Aseret Dibrot. Both models have advantages and disadvantages to them. The advantage of the model of saying that it's similar to the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, it means that we enter into the land, there was already this responsibility, which is in terms of the others, and that would be the reason that Shabbat would be missing, and therefore a correlation between what was said by Hari Griz and Harival and what's written as well, and therefore it's really a sense of this more general morality, which as a minimum is necessary for the Sheva, for the other nations. Certainly the Jews need to be following these as well, and this is just a reminder, which means don't go any lower than the standards of the nations that you're going to go into, and perhaps even know how to communicate with them. Because again, if the nations are willing to accept these, then they're able to stay in the land. If they're not willing to accept these, then they will be expelled from the land. The second approach is to say that this is essentially a repetition of Har Sinai. As a repetition of Har Sinai, you have the Mizbeach, you have the Korbanot, you have the acceptance, the Na'aseh V'Nishma, taking place, even though it's done in a more creative way in terms of two mountains and a division of the people, which while Har Sinai we have unity, this division already maybe is a little disturbing in terms of eventual divisions that will take place afterwards, but we see the correlation with the Sheva Mitzvah, and then you have this fascinating suggestion of the Abarbanel, is that this is basically, you know, the mitzvot of the Torah. And as you enter the land, they're putting up a mezuzah. And that's what the stone is. It's the mezuzah that you put up in the door as you enter the land, which again, is as far as a visual image goes, it's just a fascinating image. But as I said, I've left you today with two different approaches, and you can choose whichever approach you want. And as I said, for that matter, by your Shabbos table, after you stump them on the division of the tribes, you can then ask, okay, which one do you think it's closer correlated to, and why? Do you think it's more like the Sheva Mitzvah? Do you think it's more like the Aseret Dibrot? And there's reasons to say both, and there's reasons to say neither. Okay?
What does he say, Shem Shmuel?
Take a look at what Shem Shmuel says. Mm-hmm.